From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. And every week, usually, we focus on mental health issues from a more holistic perspective. That means finding a sense of balance between body, mind, and spirit as a way of healing our lives, healing the pain that we have inside, and finding a healthier and more effective way to be in the world, to be in relationship, and to be at peace within ourselves. And if you've been listening for the last 4 weeks, you know that the show actually was focusing more on assisting the Kerry Edwards campaign. So if we're dealing with mental health issues, I know there's a lot of us out there that are dealing with a certain degree of shock and depression right now, including me, based on the election. But the healing part of that, I guess, is moving into a place of acceptance and not stepping back from speaking our own truths and trying to get this country to be reflective of the diversity that really exists in it. So this is a live call-in show, and if you're in the Phoenix area, the number to call is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. If you're listening via the Internet, as I know some of you are because I get emails from you, it is a toll call, and it's the same number, 480-949-1310. Don't let the toll part of it stop you from calling in. So, with all that being said, I have picked the topic this week. Actually, I had scheduled my guest today, I think a couple of months ago. Her name is Susan Holt, who I'll be introducing to you in a moment. And she's a specialist, a nationally certified domestic violence counselor. And that's our topic today, domestic violence. And there are two websites in particular that I recommend, and we'll talk about later also, but one is has to do with Arizona itself, and I got a lot of statistics and information off that site, and that's www.azcadv.org. That's Arizona. It's a website dealing with Arizona and domestic violence. And then, of course, it's also the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And there is www.ncadv.org. That's the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. So there are a lot of statistics. There's a lot of information. There's a lot of things that I could open by saying, but you know what? I have a guest on this week, as I said, Susan Holt, who's an expert, unlike many that I've had on the show. She's well-known throughout the country, as well as in Los Angeles and California. And I'm going to let her tell a little bit more about herself, and I'm going to actually jump in with my guest sooner than I usually do. Susan, welcome to the show.
Lord, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for taking the time on your Saturday to do this. And we did schedule this a couple of months ago, didn't we?
We certainly did.
That's how busy you are. And the title of my show today is actually Domestic Violence, the Epidemic. And there is a lot more focusing on domestic violence issues. There's a lot more discussion. It's like a lot of other things that used to be in the closet, so to speak, and now is there more of it going on, or is it more of it just being reported and people are feeling safer identifying being victims, and that there's even more services for perpetrators at this point? Is it really an increase at this point because of maybe the tensions and chaos in our culture, or is it just that it's more is being reported because it seems to be more okay to talk about it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And many of us who work in the field believe, of course, that there's not really an increase that we're seeing at this point in time. Rather, more people are talking about domestic violence, and particularly since the O.J. Simpson trial,
right.
Domestic violence has become a topic that is really more in the awareness of the public.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, actually, because that was certainly in the headlines for more than a year, and people still talk about it.
Yeah.
So let's start with the definition. What is domestic violence? I know that there's physical, sexual, as well as psychological battering that goes on. How do you define domestic violence? How does the word battering come into play? What are your definitions that we're working with today?
Okay. Well, domestic violence is a pattern of abusive, violent, or coercive behaviors. And those behaviors are used by one individual to manipulate or control the thoughts, the beliefs, and the behaviors of his or her intimate partner, or in fact to punish the partner for resisting that control. And, you know, domestic violence is generally different from situational abuse or violence. And situational abuse can really be defined as no more than two incidents of abuse that occur as a response to a crisis in the relationship, and they do not reoccur once the crisis has been resolved.
So then it's not a pattern then. It's kind of like the difference between clinical depression and a situational depression.
That's correct.
Is what I'm hearing you say.
Yes.
And when it's situational, it's usually because there's so much going on, somebody doesn't have the coping mechanisms, and maybe years' worth of build-up or pain all of a sudden spills out, and it's an isolated incident rather than fitting a pattern of behavior.
Yes.
Okay. So you talked about thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors.
Yes.
As a method of control. And what's the difference? Are there types of perpetrators that tend to go towards one than another? Or is it a progressive thing where it tends to intensify and then encompass thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors in terms of control?
It generally is progressive, Stuart, and much of the domestic violence that we see, although not all, occurs within a cycle. And if there is no intervention for that cycle and it's not disrupted, generally what will happen is the cycle will increase in frequency and severity.
So that's kind of like when you get someone that has an episode or part of the cycle, and then all of a sudden they're just sweetness and love and everything else, so it kind of seduces the victim back into, oh, they'll change type of an attitude.
Well, that's exactly what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, in the typical cycle, there's a period of tension that builds in the relationship, and then, of course, there's the abusive incident. And following that, there's what we call the honeymoon stage. And during that period, there are a lot of apologies.
And the make-up sex.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And promises that it won't happen again. And generally, that's often the time when people will seek counseling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I keep using non-specific words to describe, I keep using words perpetrators, individuals, and things like that. But now let's talk about men and women. We know that the majority of the victims of domestic violence are women.
Yes.
And according to the statistics on the Arizona site, it says 85% of domestic violence victims are women.
Yes.
Now that does mean, obviously, that 15% are men. And that we know that battering and domestic violence goes on across the board, whether it's a heterosexual couple, homosexual, lesbian couple.
Yeah, it cuts across all barriers.
And all economic barriers and cultural barriers.
Yes.
It goes on everywhere.
Yes.
Okay, so what about, I want to actually get into the issue of that 15% that are men.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a different profile of a man who's the victim of a woman or a gay relationship who stays and is continuously staying stuck in the cycle as opposed to a woman?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to state that, you know, we don't really have a profile of a victim of domestic violence. That's because anyone can be a victim of domestic violence.
Okay.
We do have a fairly common profile of an abuser.
Okay.
Although it's also important to say that, you know, everyone is different and no profile is universal.
Right. So is, then let's take it from that side. Does the profile of the abuser match whether it's a man or a woman, or are there specific differences to the female abuser as opposed to the male abuser?
Well, generally you're going to see the same pattern of attempt to control and gain power in the relationship over the other person.
Mm-hmm.
That's not specific to gender.
Right.
Now, you know, when we're talking about gender, however, certainly there are different obstacles that female victims and male victims often encounter. And, of course, one of the biggest obstacles is a lack of resources specific to male victims.
Or economic issues, too, then. So if it's a lack of resources, then you're saying that sometimes people stay because they feel like they're helpless to leave. They have no income, they have no money, and the other person's controlling the person.
Well, and quite literally, there are no resources for them to access
okay.
in the community. And traditionally, although there are many domestic violence programs that are very, very sensitive to the needs of male victims,
mm-hmm.
many aren't equipped to actually help them. Or they're not funded to help them.
Okay.
There are a variety of different problems. And sometimes people simply don't understand that men can be victims of domestic violence. And so when men do attempt to access a service that has been traditionally designed for female victims, they sometimes encounter a lot of challenges, sometimes disbelief on the part of the service provider that they're actually being victimized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because even when I was going online, I said this to you before we went on the air, when I was going online to find websites that we could talk about or
mm-hmm.
refer people to.
Very few.
There were literally nothing that I found that was specific to men as victims.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that actually saddened me because it says to me that there's 15% of the people out there who are on the receiving end of this abuse and, like you say, have relatively few places to turn for help and have the added impact, I think, of increased humiliation and embarrassment
to
be a man who's on the end of the abuse.
Definitely.
You know, it's like I'm not man enough to take care of myself, where I would think that in a heterosexual relationship, a lot of them have just been taught you don't hit a woman, you don't deal with that. So they're between a rock and a hard place sometimes because, you know, they're being abused, and if they hit back, then they're afraid everybody else is going to see them as the bad guy.
Definitely. Definitely.
And
for gay men in particular, it's very often sometimes to even understand that what you're experiencing is, in fact, domestic violence. Because, you know, when we talk about domestic violence in our culture, we always talk about it within a heterosexual context.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in the gay and lesbian community, for instance, domestic violence is really very often an invisible problem.
Right.
And so even people who are experiencing it and experiencing severe violence may not recognize it as such.
Well, it's funny you should bring that up. And like I told you before we went on the air, it's very timely because I actually have a gay couple that I'm working with in therapy right now. And last night I got this emergency call. You know, he's throwing things at me. He's hitting me and stuff. And I said, well, get out of the house.
Uh-huh.
You know, you have to break it right now before things become worse. You need to leave. And then, you know, let things clear out in the morning. We can get some more help and talk some things through and decide what you need to do and what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got an email morning that, you know, the guy that I told to get out because, you know, it was getting dangerous for him, you know, he emails his boyfriend with this list of things that it would take for me to come back and be part of this relationship. And most of it was about an apology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you say you're sorry and if I feel you mean it,
mm-hmm.
then we have some foundation to keep working on here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearly, to me, knowing this couple, a real control battle between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned that in domestic violence, that it's, you know, control issues very often. And women do the same thing. It's like once they get the apology, they think, okay, well, they're really sorry. So where would you go if you had a couple like this? And I know you do a lot of work with gay and lesbian community in terms of domestic violence. Where would you go with a couple like this?
Well, the first thing I would do is separate them and
right.
not actually see them in couples counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Because once domestic violence has been disclosed, what we know is that couples counseling can actually be dangerous
mm-hmm.
and will very often increase the violence.
Because?
Well, there are a couple of reasons, actually. There's the assumption that both parties are equal for everything that's happening when they're being treated as a couple. That's an assumption that a lot of counselors make.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when there's domestic violence, all things aren't equal.
Mm-hmm.
And given that environment, it's absolutely impossible for the person who's being victimized to be able, after a point, to talk honestly about his or her feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Because what that can often trigger is abuse and violence following the counseling session.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually in the counseling session.
Right. Well, I've actually experienced that a little bit. You know, it's like trying to get me, the therapist, in the middle, well, Stuart said this,
yeah.
Stuart said that, and not clearly not what I did say, but, you know, using it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, that to me always implied the need to try and control and get the upper hand,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, when you're no longer seeing the two people as partners together in couples counseling, a lot of really good work can be done, but it's really important that they be seen individually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, group is absolutely the treatment of choice for people who are abusing their partners.
Right. Yeah, that I know. And I know that there are, I think, there are quite a few groups that I've heard of that actually do deal with the perpetrators, but it's still the issue of getting them to a willing place to go other than being court-ordered into it.
Yes.
Right. So what kind of process have you seen or have you used to get, whether it's a male or female abuser, to seek help and to actually accept the fact that they do have a problem and get out of their denial?
That's a really good question because it can be so challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that education about domestic violence and the fact that it will generally escalate
mm-hmm.
is really important when you're working with someone who is reluctant to get the kind of help that they really need.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to education, I think a real frank discussion about the realities, because there are definite legal consequences to domestic violence as well.
Mm-hmm. And what are they?
Well, you know, physical battery is in fact a crime.
Right.
And it's a felony. It's frequently reduced to a misdemeanor,
uh-huh.
but starts off as a felony. And there are very severe consequences for domestic violence generally, and those include certainly a fine, incarceration, being mandated to attend a batterer's intervention program.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it the sort of thing where once it reaches the point where the police are called in, does the victim actually have to press charges, or once it's a assault type of thing, can the police and the district attorney just go ahead and arrest and prosecute even without the victim's support?
Yes, you know, and I can't say definitively what it looks like in every single state
mm-hmm.
in the country, but it is not necessary for the victim to report. Generally, the police will do that.
Mm-hmm. And so we're talking then about legal issues that the perpetrators are facing, not to mention the life and death issues, you know, I mean, because some of these situations actually lead to murder.
Absolutely.
And a good percentage of them actually lead to the death of the victim.
Yes.
So
it's important for people to know, I think, while we're talking about that 75% of all domestic violence homicides occur when the victim attempts to leave the relationship. So that is, in fact, the most dangerous time.
Well, then why do they stay?
Oh,
besides the fear of the threat,
yeah.
if you leave, I'll come find you and I will get you and all that stuff, why do they stay?
Well, you know, people who stay with abusive partners do so for such a variety of reasons, but leaving is never simple. And, you know, quite honestly, a lot of people are simply too frightened by their partner's threats to even attempt to leave. And others stay because they really hope that the abuse is going to stop. Because, you know, the majority of victims don't want to necessarily leave the relationship. They just don't want to be abused. They
Right.
want the violence to stop.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the idea that when things get better in between those patterns and stuff, that, you know, they're lulled into the love that's there and the kindness that's shown them. How much of it relates to the self-esteem issues of the victim?
Yeah, well, a lot of it does, in fact, because one's self-esteem is obviously going to decrease the longer that one is in an abusive relationship. But there's something else that's really key to this that happens. Victims actually become not only victims of domestic violence, but victims of traumatic bonding.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, traumatic bonding essentially refers to a process that we saw or we witnessed with the Stockholm Syndrome or Patty Hearst, in that when one person is essentially held hostage by another, whether it's through intimidation, coercion, physical or sexual violence, that person becomes very, very bonded to the person who's in fact abusing them. And it's really kind of simple to understand when we break it down, because generally what happens is that the person who is doing the abusing is also the person who is providing for the survival needs of the person that's being victimized.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also the one after the abuse who is there to comfort the person who was victimized.
Right. That makes sense.
That's very powerful.
Yeah. I want to just talk a little bit to the listeners right now. I know that there are people who are driving in their car right now, who may have the radio on in an office or at home, who relate to the situation either personally because you've been a perpetrator or a victim of domestic violence, or because you know somebody who is currently. If you have a question and you want to get some information, or you have some comments to make on what we're talking about today with Susan Holt, I'm reminding you that the phones are open and the number is 480-949-1310. 480-949-1310. So, Susan, what about, there's a lot about elder abuse going on today. So I know that one of the statistics I got off of the Arizona site was that 2/3 of all victims of abuse over the age of 65 are women. That means 1/3 over the age of 65 are men. So this is not just something that goes on in early relationships and things like that.
No.
Elder abuse, domestic violence, which is also perpetrated by the kids who are caretakers, I understand quite a bit.
Yes.
What's the situation that you're dealing with when you're dealing with the elderly or people over 65, 70, 80?
Well, once again, you have a situation very similar to what we were talking about when we were talking about male victims, in that the elderly very often can't access appropriate resources. They're not able to physically very frequently, or there are simply no resources available that for them to really access, or at least that they're comfortable accessing.
Is there also, I guess the process is the same, but the circumstances may be different. When somebody's elderly and there's a caretaker who's like either grieving because of the aging process and the illness that's going on and maybe the imminent loss of a loved one, or they're just frustrated because having to care for this elderly person is restricting their own lifestyle and things like that. What can we say to those people who are out there who are dealing with those frustrations? I would think that it's similar to even in the earlier age groups and stuff, that it's something being pent up and building over time. Is it a situational thing that you're saying more with elder abuse, or are these people tend to be abusive people to begin with?
Generally, people tend to be abusive to begin with, and that's actually because of a lot of reasons. You know, but it's interesting because when we talk about domestic violence, I think that we tend to attribute it to many, many things. We often attribute it to stress, illness, anger management problems, substance use, impulse control problems,
right,
all kinds of things. And it's important to know that none of those things really cause someone to be abusive. They can exacerbate the situation so that someone actually loses control of their impulses. Okay, and may batter another person. But once again, when we're talking about domestic violence, I think it's really important to differentiate between situational abuse and domestic violence. Domestic violence being something that occurs within a pattern.
Well, but you mentioned a few things here that, you know, we're talking about management, anger management issues, we're talking about self-esteem issues, we're talking about impulse control issues.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying those are not the reasons why somebody becomes a batterer or, you know, someone who's dealing with domestic violence.
Right.
So if those are more, I hate to say the symptoms and not really the problem.
Right.
What's the problem?
Well, the problem really boils down to one of several things. First of all, violent behavior is learned. And that's important to note because it can be unlearned.
Which means there's often a generational pattern, too, or, you know, a multi-generational pattern.
Most commonly.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, when something is learned, it's reinforced generally. And we have a culture that really reinforces the value of violence.
Well, definitely. You know, I'm a proponent of free speech, we definitely see an abundance of films and television shows. And, I mean, the most popular shows on TV right now are the mystery shows of how to solve murders. You know, I mean, CSI and Law and Order and all these other things, while they're intriguing and, you know, great to see the unfolding of a mystery, they're all really about violence in our society.
Yeah.
So if it's learned, if it can be multi-generational and passed down, you're also saying it can be unlearned. So you're talking about, then you are talking about like anger management classes and group therapy and things like that.
I am. It's important to differentiate anger management from treatment for battering,
mm-hmm.
because they're not one and the same, and actually many people think that they are.
Okay.
Now, anger management can be helpful, but it's not enough to help someone change a pattern of using violent or coercive behaviors.
Mm-hmm. So what is necessary?
Well,
if that's not enough, what is necessary?
It's really important that people seek out batterer's intervention treatment with someone who is a domestic violence specialist. And it's important that they stick with the treatment if they're not mandated. You know, treatment to change violent behaviors, if one's developed a pattern of them, can take a fair amount of time.
Well, what I'm getting at, though, is can I get some more specifics as to what those programs actually do, what they focus on, what's the approach and the intent?
You know, they're all different. We're at a point in time when people are really trying to determine what the best way to treat battering is.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is we don't know that yet.
Okay.
But a lot of the programs will actually include a very large anger management component, you know, and that's really just a lot of tools and techniques that people are taught about how to manage their anger.
Mm-hmm.
But then the majority of programs also have a very large psychoeducational component.
Mm-hmm.
And that educational component really looks at, in depth, what domestic violence is.
In other words, raise one's consciousness so that they're more tuned into how they contribute to their behaviors so that maybe they'll be able to make some changes and have a better sense of control over those behaviors.
Yes. And, you know, many, many topics are explored during the course of batterer's intervention. You know, the group will talk about substance abuse and how it impacts domestic violence. And it will talk about the impact that domestic violence has on children. So there's a wealth of information that can actually be helpful to people while they're learning to practice the tools that they're getting.
Right. Well, you mentioned something I was actually going to bring up, because a lot of what we're talking about sounds very similar to addiction counseling,
mm-hmm.
where you have the issues of denial, you have the issues of the need to educate oneself about what the addictive process is, the cross-generational issues, the need for community and group support in terms of stopping the addictive behavior. So there seems to be a lot of overlap to the patterns between domestic violence and addictions, and the fact that drugs and alcohol play a significant role very often in those periods when the domestic violence is going on.
Yeah, from our understanding, drugs and alcohol play a role in about 70% of all of the incidents of domestic violence.
So then treatment for the domestic violence is also the need for recovery in terms of drugs, alcohol, and other addictive problems.
Concurrent treatment.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Because people need help with both, because while they're very similar, they're different problems. And, you know, if someone gets treatment for substance use and they go into recovery and they're maintaining their recovery, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to stop their battering behavior.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could easily see, because, you know, they may not be using the drugs or the alcohol anymore. They may be dealing with the sobriety and recovery issues, but I would think there is a certain degree of release and satisfaction that a batterer experiences when they are actually abusing. That there is some kind of shift in energy, and kind of like a volcano building up, and then it explodes, and there's that quiet afterwards, that pattern still exists even without the drugs and the alcohol buying into it.
Very, very commonly.
Yeah.
Not with all batterers, but with many of them, yes.
Mm-hmm. So the drugs and the alcohol, in a sense, merely gave them a subconscious permission, because their inhibitions are now down and the drugs and the alcohol, it's easy to blame the drugs and the alcohol and not take responsibility for the abusive behavior.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned something else that I think is very important to talk about, and that has to do with children.
Yes.
Because in most situations, there are children present, there are children witnessing this, and I can't tell you how many adult clients I work with who are dealing with issues in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s because of what they witnessed happening to their mother,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes their father, when
yes.
they were children, and
yes.
how this is still a part of their own problems with intimacy and relationships, even if they're not continuing the pattern of abuse themselves. There are so much that it's impacting these adults from their childhood.
Absolutely. You know, the estimates really vary on this now, but we tend to believe that approximately 85% of children in abusive households are aware of the violence, even if they're not in the same room.
Mm-hmm. And that they are often the recipient of the abuse.
Very frequently.
You know, if dad runs out of, you know, mom, or the kid's handier in a certain moment, then the kid may be the one getting it.
Absolutely.
And sometimes the kids are the ones, is it still considered, I know it's child abuse, but is it still under the guise of domestic violence if it's the children that are being abused, and let's say by the dad, or sometimes by the mom, and the other parent is not doing anything to intervene? Is that domestic violence or child abuse, or is it?
Well, it's both.
Yeah, I know, but is it categorized as both? In other words, you hear it talked about as child abuse a lot, but is this still under the heading of domestic violence?
It is.
In the household.
It is indeed.
And do these programs usually deal with the kids?
Hopefully.
Okay. So they're usually, if the mom gets out of there, I would assume they usually take the kids with them. And how do the programs deal with what the kids are going through? I mean, are there counselors at these programs that deal specifically with the children?
Yes.
Okay. So, with all of these issues, I mean, obviously we know that whatever happens in one's life young spills over into who we are as adults. I want to talk also about what you're recommending to men or women who are in the middle of this cycle in terms of getting out of it.
Okay.
Where can they turn? What can they do? Other than these websites that I mentioned earlier on, what do you suggest?
Right. Well, the first thing I want to say is safety is always primary.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first goal. And if someone's being physically assaulted, they need to seek medical attention or call 911.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important for people who are being battered to talk to a domestic violence specialist immediately. And if they're not, if they can't find a domestic violence specialist, or they're working with a counselor and don't want to seek help from someone else specifically for domestic violence, it's important that they know how much training in domestic violence that service provider has received.
Mm-hmm.
It's also really important to remember that leaving an abusive partner without a safety plan and without support and information about realistic options is dangerous, and it can be life-threatening.
Right, and it's usually why they end up going back.
Very frequently.
Yeah, because they're scared and they don't know where else to turn. They have no plan, and they think that going back to that house is their only option.
Yes.
So how do they develop a plan like this? I mean, what do you suggest? What should be part of this plan?
There are a number of things that should be part of the plan, but, you know, one of the first things that people need to do is establish contact with friends and family so that they have a place, a safe place to go in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to develop resources that they can easily access too. If for some reason those friends or family members can't or won't be available to them. Now, all of this can be done in conjunction with someone who is very knowledgeable about domestic violence. You know, it's really as simple as calling, for instance, the National Domestic Violence Hotline.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that number handy?
Yes, I do. It's 1-800-799-7233 or 1-800-799-7233. Okay. Or an easy way to remember it is 1-800-799-SAFE.
Oh, good. And so having that number. Now, actually, on the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, they actually have a page that is called Safety Planning.
Yeah.
And some of the things you mentioned are on there, but I'd like to read those things and have you comment. If you are still in a relationship, it says, think of a safe place to go if an argument occurs. Avoid rooms with no exits, like the bathroom, or rooms with weapons, like a kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not something most people would think of. Most people think
right.
Running into the bathroom might be the safest place,
right.
There's usually a lock on that door.
Yeah.
But, you know, we saw in The Shining that the lock on the door didn't help them when they ran into the bathroom.
That's right.
Number two, it says, think about and make a list of safe people to contact, which is what you said.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, keep change with you at all times so you can use a payphone, although I think this was probably written before the prevalence of cell phones. In fact, I know that there's a lot of safe houses or shelters that
mm-hmm.
look for donations of used cell phones so that
mm-hmm.
women who can't afford them can be given a cell phone in case of this.
Yes.
So if people are out there and we're always replacing our cell phones, don't just throw them away. Donate them to, you know, abuse shelter, because they can give them to the women who can't afford these phones and help them set up a number so they can at least dial 911 or dial the shelter when they have an emergency.
Absolutely.
Memorize all important numbers. And number five is establish a code word or sign so that family, friends, teachers, and coworkers know when to call for help.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important, because if you're talking to them and the perpetrator is right there, you're not going to be able to say it clearly. But that would be a good way to give them the message, I need help, this is the code word.
Right.
Think about what you will say to your partner if he or she becomes violent. In other words, I would think that implies soft-spoken things that are not going to accelerate the incident. What does that mean?
It can really
say to your partner.
Yeah, it can really depend. You know, the person who's being victimized is an expert on what is going to escalate the abuse. And so they generally know exactly what the partner needs to hear.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, and this is as a therapist who's worked with a lot of couples over the years, gay and straight, is people also know what words and phrases will trigger.
Oh, sure.
And very mm-hmm. often they're feeding into it and doing it almost deliberately as if they're saying, I know this is going to lead to that. And in other words, there's that codependent, dysfunctional, symbiotic type of thing that goes on in an abusive relationship sometimes, where the person who's being abused is not even conscious of what they're doing actually to perpetuate the whole thing. It's
well,
not to say they're at fault, but, you know, they're part of the cycle, and unless they're willing to break that cycle, they need to see how they're contributing to it.
Yeah, you know, the reality is for a lot of victims that are really trapped inside the cycle of violence that we talked about earlier, what will generally happen is because the tension building stage of that cycle is so very uncomfortable and scary that victims will do something that they believe will often provoke the abusive behavior or violence. You know, and when you say it makes perfect sense, of course.
Just to get it over with.
Yes.
Because they know it's coming, they can feel it building, and the quickest way to get to the other side of it is, okay, I know it's going to be hard, but let's at least get past it and we get back to the good feelings again.
That's right.
Right. So people who are listening to that, you're hearing these words, can you hear how insane that sounds, and yet in the moment, it's the sanest thinking that that person has to use?
Definitely.
It makes total sense, even
yes.
though it's dangerous thinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, the last thing that they put on this list is, and this is important, remember you have the right to live without fear and violence in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say that again. Remember, we all have the right to live without fear and to live without violence in our lives. That goes for relationships, that goes for our communities, that goes within our country. Everyone has the right to live without fear and violence.
Yes.
Now,
everyone deserves to be respected.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you've left the relationship already, they have another list of things here, like changing your phone number and keeping it unlisted and don't give it to anyone other than your closest relatives and make sure they know it's a new number.
And that's so important because many people think that once they're out of the relationship or the victim has left that they're safe, and that, in fact, isn't true at all. And people can be stalked for literally years
right.
by their abusive partners.
And then it says, now we have caller ID, so it says screen calls. Whether you're using an answering machine and listening, you know, or you have caller ID, you know, we have high-tech ways of screening calls today. Don't pick up the phone unless you know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, save and document all contacts, messages, injuries, or other incidents involving the batterer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the way to document the pattern again, so that if you're, you know, looking for a restraining order or if you need to report it so this person gets arrested and taken off the streets, you have concrete times and places and witnesses in order to document this.
Yes.
Do a lot of the women or the men who are being battered actually, are they conscious enough and aware enough to be able to write all this stuff down in your experience?
Very frequently, no.
Yeah, I would say. So it's a good thing to be able to do. And what I suggest to people in a situation like that is carry a little notebook, a notepad in your purse, in your pocket, or something where you could at least write down a quick note.
Right, just a tiny little piece of paper with an important phone number on it.
Right. Now, it also says change locks if the batterer has a key. Avoid staying alone. Plan how to get away if confronted by an abusive partner. It's the same thing as having a fire plan in your house. How do I get out if a fire breaks out in this house?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. What's the exit strategy if all of a sudden they show up at the front door?
Mm-hmm.
And again, a lot of people don't think to look at what are the ways out, who to call. You know, if you have a security system on your house, there's usually a panic button on that too.
Right.
So if that person shows up and you let the police know in advance, if this panic goes off, it's because this abusive person's at my door. Please come.
Right.
So it's important to let the police know in advance you have this situation so that they do respond to the alarm system.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to meet your partner, do it in a public place. Vary your routine. So that you're not in the same, and your children's routine too, I would imagine.
Although that won't necessarily stop abuse and violence from happening.
Yeah. But at least it makes it a little bit more difficult.
A little bit more challenging.
Okay. And call a shelter, you know, as we've been talking about. So there's some good things on this, on these websites. And again, whether you get to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, where I just read those items, or if you're living in the Phoenix area, like I said, there is the Arizona Association for Domestic Violence.
Right. It's the Arizona Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And
right.
I believe they're actually in Phoenix.
They are. It's at 100 West Camelback Road, Suite 109. And their number, in case somebody wants to call them for information, is 800-782-6400. That's 1-800-782-6400. And they are in Phoenix on Camelback Road.
You know, there are so fewer resources for gays and lesbians, but there is one resource in Arizona, in Tucson, actually.
Oh, what is that?
Specifically for gays and lesbians who are experiencing domestic violence, and the name of that organization is Wingspan.
Okay, do you have a phone number for them?
Yes, it's 1-800-553-9387.
Say it again.
1-800-553-9387.
And with that being said, I know that we hardly even got into, I know we talked a lot about, you know, gay and lesbian relationships in relationship to domestic violence today, but you actually administer a program in Los Angeles at the Gay and Lesbian Center that deals specifically with domestic violence against GLBTs.
Yes, I do.
And what's the name of that program, or is this a part of the Gay and Lesbian Center?
It's the Stop Partner Abuse and Domestic Violence Program, and that actually stands for Support, Treatment and Intervention, Outreach, Education, and Prevention of Same-Gender Partner Abuse.
Okay, and if somebody wants to reach you and has a question, do you have an email or a website or something like that?
We have both.
Okay, what?
Phone number is 323-860-5806. 860-5806 in the 323 area code.
And the website?
The website is www.laglc.org/domestic-violence, all one word. And for people who would like to email us, that address is domesticviolence@laglc.org.
And I'm going to actually post this on my website for the show, so if people didn't have a chance to write it down, much easier, they could go to tellthetruthfaster.com. And this show, within a week or so, will be archived, so if you want somebody who wasn't listening today to listen to what Susan and I have had to say about domestic violence issues, you can listen to that show on my list of archives or any show I've done over the last 3 years. So you have a minute or two. Is there some point you want to make that I haven't asked or something you really want to bring home that's really important before I thank you?
Yeah, you know, I generally like to tell people that although this is an epidemic, and it happens to as many as 1 in 3 people, it's something that we can stop. You know, we can talk to our elected officials and encourage them to fund domestic violence programs. We can talk to our friends and our family members and increase their awareness about this. It's an epidemic, but it's one that we can prevent. I have a lot of hope for that.
Right. I really want to thank you again, Susan Holt, for being on the show today. It's a very important topic, and I know you've dedicated your career to dealing with this, and I really admire that and just sing your praises for having done that.
Thank you.
So thanks for being on the show. I want to thank my listeners. This is Stuart Altshuler on Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix, Arizona. Be here next week again. With the change in the time clocks, I remind people who are not in Arizona that it's now at noon Pacific time, still at 1 o'clock Arizona time. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again next week with Tell the Truth Faster.
That I heard of one.